Chapter 97. The happy pair, the dark blot on the street is gone. Mr. Domney's mansion, if it be a gap among the other houses any longer, is only so, because it is not to be vied within its brightness, and haughtily casts them off. The saying is, that home is home, be it never so homely. If it hold good in the opposite contingency, and home is home be it never so stately, what an altar to the household gods is raised up here. Lights are sparkling in the windows this evening, and the ruddy glow of fires is warm and bright upon the hangings and soft carpets, and the dinner waits to be served, and the dinner table is handsomely set forth, though only for four persons, and the sideboard is cumbrous with plate. It is the first time that the house has been arranged for occupation since its late changes, and the happy pair are looked for every minute. Only second to the wedding morning, in the interest and expectation it engenders among the household, is this evening of the coming home. Mrs. Perch is in the kitchen taking tea, and has made the tour of the establishment, and priced the silks and damasks by the yard, and exhausted every interjection in the dictionary, and out of it expressive of admiration and wonder. The upholsterer's foreman, who has left his hat, with a pocket handkerchief in it, both smelling strongly of varnish, under a chair in the hall, lurks about the house, gazing upwards at the cornices, and downward at the carpets, and occasionally, in a silent transport of enjoyment, taking a rule out of his pocket, and skirmishingly measuring expensive objects, with unutterable feelings. Cook is in high spirits, and says give her a place, where there's plenty of company, as she'll bet you sixpence there will be now, for she is of a lively disposition, and she always was from a child, and she don't mind who knows it, which sentiment elicits from the breast of Mrs. Perch a responsive murmur of support and approbation. All the housemaid hopes is happiness for 'em, but marriage is a lottery, and the more she thinks about it, the more she feels the independence and the safety of a single life. Mr. Towlinson is saturnine and grim and says that's his opinion too, and give him war besides, and down with the French, for this young man has a general impression that every foreigner is a Frenchman and must be by the laws of nature. At each new sound of wheels, they all stop greater than whatever they are saying, and listen, and more than once there is a general starting up, and a cry of here they are, apostrophe apostrophe, but here they are not yet, and cook begins to mourn over the dinner, which has been put back twice, and the upholsterer's foreman still goes lurking about the rooms, undisturbed in his blissful reverie. Florence is ready to receive her father and her new mama, whether the emotions that are throbbing in her breast originate in pleasure or in pain, she hardly knows. But the fluttering heart sends added color to her cheeks, and brightness to her eyes, and they say downstairs, drawing their heads together, for they always speak softly, when they speak of her, how beautiful Miss Florence looks tonight, and what a sweet young lady she has grown, poor dear. A pause succeeds, and then cook, feeling, as president, that her sentiments are waited for, wonders whether and there stops. The housemaid wonders too, and so does Mrs. Perch, who has the happy social faculty of always wondering when other people wonder, without being at all particular what she wonders at. Mr. Towlinson, who now descries an opportunity of bringing down the spirits of the ladies to his own level, says wait and see. He wishes some people were well out of this. Cook leads a sigh then, and a murmur of ah, it's a strange world, it is indeed. Apostrophe apostrophe, and when it has gone round the table, adds persuasively, but Miss Florence can't well be the worse for any change, Tom. Apostrophe Mr. Towlinson's rejoinder, pregnant with frightful meaning, is oh, can't she though? Apostrophe apostrophe, and sensible that a mere man can scarcely be more prophetic or improve upon that, he holds his peace. Mrs. Skewton, prepared to greet her darling daughter and dear son-in-law with open arms, is appropriately attired for that purpose in a very youthful costume with short sleeves. At present, however, her ripe charms are blooming in the shade of her own apartments, whence she had not emerged, since she took possession of them a few hours ago, and where she is fast growing fretful, on account of the postponement of dinner. The maid who ought to be a skeleton, but is in truth a buxom damsel, is, on the other hand, in a most amiable state, considering her quarterly stipend much safer than heretofore, and foreseeing a great improvement in her board and lodging. Where are the happy pair, for whom this brave home is waiting? Do steam, tide, wind, and horses, all abate their speed, to linger on such happiness? Does the swarm of loves and graces hovering about them retard their progress by its numbers? Are there so many flowers in their happy path, that they can scarcely move along, without entanglement in thornless roses, and sweetest briar? They are here at last. The noise of wheels is heard, grows louder, and a carriage drives up to the door. A thundering knock from the obnoxious foreigner anticipates the rush of Mr. Towlinson and party to open it, and Mr. Dombey and his bride alight, and walk in arm. My sweetest Edith! Cries an agitated voice upon the stairs. My dearest Dombey! And the short sleeves wreath themselves about the happy couple in turn, and embrace them. Florence had come down to the hall too, but did not advance, reserving her timid welcome until these nearer and dearer transports should subside. But the eyes of Edith sought her out, upon the threshold, and dismissing her sensitive parent with a slight kiss on the cheek, she hurried on to Florence and embraced her. How do you do, Florence? Said Mr. Dombey, putting out his hand. As Florence, trembling, raised it to her lips, she met his glance. The look was cold and distant enough, but it stirred her heart to think that she observed in it something more of interest than he had ever shown before. It even expressed a kind of faint surprise, and not a disagreeable surprise, at sight of her. She dared not raise her eyes to his any more, but she felt that he looked at her once again, and not less favorably. Oh, what a thrill of joy shot through her, awakened by even this intangible and baseless confirmation of her hope, that she would learn to win him, through her new and beautiful mamma. You will not be long dressing, Mrs. Dombey, I presume? Said Mr. Dombey. I shall be ready immediately. Let them send up dinner in a quarter of an hour. With that Mr. Dombey stalked away to his own dressing room, and Mrs. Dombey went upstairs to hers. Mrs. Skewton and Florence repaired to the drawing room, where that excellent mother considered it incumbent on her to shed a few irrepressible tears, supposed to be forced from her by her daughter's felicity, and which she was still drying, very gingerly, with a lace corner of her pocket handkerchief, when her son-in-law appeared. And how, my dearest Dombey, did you find that delightfulest of cities, Paris? She asked, subduing her emotion. It was cold, returned Mr. Dombey. Gay as ever, said Mrs. Skewton, of course. Not particularly. I thought it dull, said Mr. Dombey. Fie, my dearest Dombey. Archly, dull. It made that impression upon me, madam, said Mr. Dombey, with grave politeness. I believe Mrs. Dombey found it dull too. She mentioned once or twice that she thought it so. Why, you naughty girl! Cried Mrs. Skewton, rallying her dear child, who now entered. What dreadfully heretical things have you been saying about Paris? Edith raised her eyebrows with an air of weariness, and passing the folding doors which were thrown open, to display the suite of rooms in their new and handsome garniture, and barely glancing at them as she passed, sat down by Florence. My dear Dombey, said Mrs. Skewton, how charmingly these people have carried out every idea that we hinted. They have made a perfect palace of the house, positively. It is handsome, said Mr. Dombey, looking round. I directed that no expense should be spared, and all that money could do, has been done, I believe. apostrophe, and what can it not do, dear Dombey? Apostrophe, apostrophe, observed Cleopatra. It is powerful, madam, apostrophe, said Mr. Dombey. He looked in his solemn way towards his wife, but not a word said she. I hope, Mrs. Dombey, apostrophe, addressing her after a moment's silence, with a special distinctness, that these alterations meet with your approval? Apostrophe, apostrophe, they are as handsome as they can be, apostrophe, she returned, with haughty carelessness. They should be so, of course. And I suppose they are. Apostrophe, an expression of scorn was habitual to the proud face, and seemed inseparable from it. But the contempt with which it received any appeal to admiration, respect, or consideration on the ground of his riches, no matter how slight or ordinary in itself, was a new and different expression, unequaled in intensity by any other of which it was capable. Whether Mr. Dombey, wrapped in his own greatness, was at all aware of this, or no, there had not been wanting opportunities already for his complete enlightenment. And at that moment it might have been affected by the one glance of the dark eye that lighted on him, after it had rapidly and scornfully surveyed the theme of his self-glorification. He might have read in that one glance, that nothing that his wealth could do, though it were increased 10,000-fold, could win him for its own sake, one look of softened recognition from the defiant woman, linked to him, but arrayed with her whole soul against him. He might have read in that one glance, that even for its sordid and mercenary influence upon herself, she spurned it, while she claimed its utmost power as her right, her bargain as the base and worthless recompense for which she had become his wife. He might have read in it that, ever bearing her own head for the lightning of her own contempt and pride to strike, the most innocent allusion to the power of his riches degraded her anew, sunk her deeper in her own respect, and made the blight and waste within her more complete. But dinner was announced, and Mr. Dombey led down Cleopatra, Edith and his daughter following. Sweeping past the gold and silver demonstration on the sideboard, as if it were heaped up dirt, and deigning to bestow no look upon the elegancies around her, she took her place at his board for the first time, and sat, like a statue, at the feast. Mr. Dombey, being a good deal in the statue way himself, was well enough pleased to see his handsome wife immovable and proud and cold. Her deportment being always elegant and graceful, this as a general behavior was agreeable and congenial to him. Presiding, therefore, with his accustomed dignity, and not at all reflecting on his wife by any warmth or hilarity of his own, he performed his share of the honors of the table with a cool satisfaction. And the installation dinner, though not regarded downstairs as a great success, or very promising beginning, passed oil, above, in a sufficiently polite, genteel, and frosty manner. Soon after tea Mrs. Skewton, who affected to be quite overcome, and worn out by her emotions of happiness, arising in the contemplation of her dear child united to the man of her heart, but who, there is reason to suppose, found this family party somewhat dull, as she yawned for 1 hour continually behind her fan, retired to bed. Edith, also, silently withdrew and came back no more. Thus, it happened that Florence, who had been upstairs to have some conversation with Diogenes, returning to the drawing room with her little work basket, found no one there but her father, who was walking to and fro, in dreary magnificence. I beg your pardon. Shall I go away, Papa? Apostrophe said Florence faintly, hesitating at the door. No, apostrophe returned Mr. Dombey, looking round over his shoulder. You can come and go here, Florence, as you please. This is not my private room. Florence entered, and sat down at a distant little table with her work. Finding herself for the first time in her life, for the very first time within her memory from her infancy to that hour alone with her father, as his companion. She, his natural companion. His only child, who in her lonely life and grief had known the suffering of a breaking heart, who, in her rejected love, had never breathed his name to God at night, but with a tearful blessing, heavier on him than a curse, who had prayed to die young, so she might only die in his arms, who had, all through, repaid the agony of slight and coldness, and dislike, with patient unexacting love, excusing him, and pleading for him, like his better angel. She trembled, and her eyes were dim. His figure seemed to grow in height and bulk before her as he paced the room. Now it was all blurred and indistinct, now clear again, and plain, and now she seemed to think that this had happened, just the same, a multitude of years ago. She yearned towards him, and yet shrunk from his approach. A natural emotion in a child, innocent of wrong. A natural the hand that had directed the sharp plow, which furrowed up her gentle nature for the sowing of its seeds. Bent upon not distressing or offending him by her distress, Florence controlled herself, and sat quietly at her work. After a few more turns across and across the room, he left off pacing it, and withdrawing into a shadowy corner at some distance, where there was an easy chair, covered his head with a handkerchief, and composed himself to sleep. It was enough for Florence to sit there watching him, turning her eyes towards his chair from time to time, watching him with her thoughts, when her face was intent upon her work, and sorrowfully glad to think that he could sleep while she was there, and that he was not made restless by her strange and long forbidden presence. What would have been her thoughts if she had known that he was steadily regarding her, that the veil upon his face, by accident or by design, was so adjusted that his sight was free, and that it never wandered from her face an instant, that when she looked towards him in the obscure dark corner, her speaking eyes, more earnest and pathetic in their voiceless speech than all the orators of all the world, and impeaching him more nearly in their mute address, met his, and did not know it. That when she bent her head again over her work, he drew his breath more easily, but with the same attention looked upon her still upon her white brow and her falling hair, and busy hands, and once attracted, seemed to have no power to turn his eyes away. And what were his thoughts meanwhile? With what emotions did he prolong the attentive gaze covertly directed on his unknown daughter? Was there reproach to him in the quiet figure and the mild eyes? Had he begun to her disregarded claims, and did they touch him home at last, and waken him to some sense of his cruel injustice? There are yielding moments in the lives of the sternest and harshest men, though such men often keep their secret well. The sight of her in her beauty, almost changed into a woman without his knowledge, may have struck out some such moments even in his life of pride. Some passing thought that he had a happy home within his reach, had a household spirit bending at his feet had overlooked it in his stiff-necked sullen arrogance, and wandered away and lost himself, may have engendered them. Some simple eloquence distinctly heard, though only uttered in her eyes, unconscious that he read them as be the deathbeds I have tended, by the childhood I have suffered, by our meeting in this dreary house at midnight, by the cry wrung from Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.